where we left off last week, so we dovetail perfectly now that Rabbi Elias is here, because Rabbi Elias made it into my last subject, which was the history of Hillel and Beth Jacob. Hillel and Beth Jacob, I did mention you in passing in one of the stories over there, and therefore it's perfect we come to the next chapter in the history of Orthodox Judaism in L.A. For those who have been following, we're up to part 6. Part 5, I had to cancel, so I owe people part 5, which is the history of Shaar Tefillah, Modern Orthodoxy, and Yavna in Los Angeles. And we're covering today instead the history of the Iranian community here in Los Angeles. It's a perfect segue from Beth Jacob, and you'll realize in a moment why the Beth Jacob story transitions well into the story of the Iranian community in Los Angeles. Los Angeles has the largest concentration of Iranians outside of Iran, more than any other city. The most recent estimates puts us somewhere at around 80,000 people. 80,000 Iranians are here in Los Angeles at this point. Those are conservative estimates. We may be well ahead of that at this point. Some want to argue those estimates were based on those who identified as even just being Jewish. Even just being Jewish, those numbers are certainly growing. The story doesn't begin when they first came to Los Angeles. This story begins 1921. 1921, Mohammad Reza Shah, his father, creates what is ultimately a revolution for the people of Iran. It is the first time in hundreds of years that there's a clear separation between religion and politics, between people's secular life and their religious life in the country. And this brings tremendous freedom to the Jewish people of Iran. His son, Mohammad Reza Shah, and the Pahlavi dynasty are going to represent a significant turn for the Jewish people, what's going to be called the Golden Age of Iran, what's going to be considered a time of great prosperity, a time of tremendous opportunity, scholarship, growth in so many areas. That is all going to crumble in 1979, with the Ayatollah Khomeini coming to power, bringing in his Shiite doctrine, his concept of Nejasat, where Jews are considered tameh, disgusting, like pigs, vermin, that we should not interact with. Now, mind you, he did not create that anew in Iran. Jews lived under that premise, while even in the Golden Age, they lived under that premise of being kept at a distance, that you don't get too close. But it was a liberal or a more secular understanding of the distance, not a religious understanding of the distance. So Reza Shah comes to power, the Shah, as he is known today, 1941, and that is going to signify the zenith for Jewish life in Iran. When do Iranians come to Los Angeles? When do they get here? Everyone thinks the movement begins in 1979 with the revolution. It's not true. The revolution actually begins for Jews here in Los Angeles many years before that. Why? Because as the economy is growing in Iran, many in the Jewish community realize we have a great opportunity here. Let's send our children to go get an education out in America. Let's send them to USC. Let's send them to Irvine. Let's send them to UCLA. Let's send our children out west. They'll get a westernized education. They'll come back with the best in technology, arts, culture, and they'll come back to the host country, to the mother country, and be able to impact in a positive way. The Shah himself, a very liberal individual by Eastern standards, supported this immensely and would sign the papers for as many Jews as needed to go get an education. So many actually came with the intent of coming back. Why LA? That's the big mystery, why LA? If you stop 9 out of 10 Iranians and you ask them, why LA? They'll answer you with probably the weather got everything off the ground. It's funny how places become the stopping point. Already in the history of Orthodox LA, I pointed out how many famous Hasidic Rebbes came to LA simply because of the weather. They came because they needed a better place to live for their lungs, for their condition, whatever illnesses they had. They were told, keep going west, go to Los Angeles, go to California. And the hospitals here, which were built by Jews, as we mentioned in our opening and second history lecture, which were built by Jews, Cedar Sinai and hospitals that predated it, were able to service those people who could not, who needed the extra help as far as their health was concerned. But that wasn't the same issue in the 70s. No one had illnesses that they came to California for. When you say you come to California for the weather in the 70s, it means something else entirely. It means sunny, bright, and shiny LA. I think people came to LA in the 1970s, why Iranians came to LA, Not because of the weather. They came because God put them here. They came because they were about to begin a journey that's going to unfold in front of our very eyes. A piece of Jewish history that was going to continue in a very unique way. When Khomeini comes to power in 1979, when the revolution actually takes full form, it was brewing already for a little while. When the revolution begins to kick in, many of the wealthy are trying to get out of there as quick as possible. Why? Because they're the ones getting in trouble first. Why? If you ask Khomeini and his regime why the wealthy are getting in trouble first, he would tell you, surely they are the biggest Zionist supporters. They are the ones with the money, they're the ones supporting Zionism. Well, those who didn't even have a dollar to their name given towards Zionism were included in those getting in trouble. What did this then mean? It meant that the Khomeini was using Zionism as a pretext by which he could take Jewish money. They had the money. They had a lot of the wealth. If we can get to them and say they're traitors, they're not loyal to their host country, we can take their money away. We can take that from them. That's one part of the story. That's one part of the story. There is at one moment, and I want to tell you this, of a sad story, which I think is a trigger for many people leaving. And those who live there can tell you even better that this was part of it. There was one figure, and he's mentioned here, I just caught this, the Shofet family had passed me some articles from their father. The Shofet family pointed out about a gentleman by the name of Mr. Habib Elganian. Mr. Habib Elganian was an individual who was extremely wealthy. He ran factories. He gave jobs to hundreds upon hundreds of Iranians, Jews and non-Jews alike, Jews and Muslims and Baha'i. He gave jobs to anybody who needed jobs. They threw him in prison. They threw him in jail. Why did they throw him in jail? He must be a Zionist supporter. Now, I don't know if he ever gave a check to the JNF or not, but it was irrelevant. And he was killed on the spot. He was killed as a traitor. That, to people, told them this pachad, this fear that had been growing within us, it's real. It's not a joke. It's not a game. And for that, they left. For that, the Jews started to really begin to leave and meet their host family back in Los Angeles. Well, maybe you could turn to the secret police of the Shah. They were loyal people. They were good people who had a relationship with the Jews before the revolution. That was too late as well. The Khomeini had all the secret police in his pocket, which meant all the deep, dark secrets of the Iranians who were supporting the Shah, who had helped prop up his government, who supported his Western values. All of that information would be downloaded, if it hadn't been downloaded already, and given to Khomeini. Given to Khomeini. Many leaders in the Iranian community, those in Tehran, those in Shiraz, met with members of the Shin Bet, privately met with members of the Shin Bet. By the way, in the next few years, the next 5 to 10 years, a lot of those stories are going to begin to come out. The reason we don't hear a lot of them is because many of these individuals are afraid of incriminating their families that are still behind, that have still chosen to stay behind or can't leave, who are still behind in Tehran. Many met with the Shin Bet to arrange how far every Jew is from the airport, how we can get a whole bunch of them out of there with their property, who could come out even without their property. Jews made dangerous treks into Pakistan, risking their lives, risking malaria, risking everything, all for the sake of finding a better life, of finding freedom. Now, where did they get this idea that it would be so dangerous? You understand, there's a belief that anything that happens to the Jewish community happens almost in a sense in a parallel way to all the Jewish community. You know, we say Maisa Ava Simen Labanim, what happens to the fathers happens to the children. And when we look what affected or the mindset of the Jewish community in pre-war Holocaust, pre-Nazi Europe, the mindset that they went through, well, should we leave? This can't really be happening. This, what we think is going to be happening, what we're told is going to be happening, can't really be happening. That sudden denial, that initial denial was here as well. This can't be what's happening. Life was too good for too many of us for this really to be unfolding the way it is. But many did choose to leave. And they remembered that while the Shah was a friend, they knew there was a history of hatred for Jews. There was a tremendous massacre that us Ashkenazi Jews, those of Western Jews, aren't familiar of. We think the problem started in the late 70s, early 80s. We don't realize in the 1800s you have the massacre of Tabriz, where the clergy went wild and just started killing, rampant killing Jews. The notion of a pogrom was not limited to Western Jews or Western or Eastern European Jews. It existed for Jews worldwide. And this pachad, this fear, was everywhere. Well, maybe the intellectuals were spared. Why? They got to meet with the Khomeini. They had a private meeting. And the Khomeini said, I won't touch you. I'll leave you alone. Why? Because you're not Zionists. You're academics. You're intellectuals. At the Isfahan University of Art, in that college, in that university, was one of the world's greatest authorities on color. Someone who's published 13 books on color. On the nature of color, how we interact with color. Is there even such a thing as color? Or is it just the perception of sun reflecting off the ground? This individual is a Jew. Students walked out of his class and refused to take his course. Why? This brilliant professor, the world's leading authority on color, is sitting right in front of them. Why? He's a Zionist. Was he? I don't know. Again, did he have family members who lived in Israel? I don't know. But already, the term Zionist is synonymous with a Jew. One and two, they go together. They are part and parcel of the same destiny. When we hear their story, we can relate to it because we understand. When I say those of Ashkenazi descent can relate to it, because we understand the host country turning their backs on us. We understand that concept. Americans as a whole don't understand that concept. They think it's a myth and a fantasy. They don't understand the concept of Taria. Taria is the notion, it's an Islamic notion, that you could lie, cheat, and steal to do what it is you need to do to eliminate the enemy. If someone is an infidel, if someone is an enemy, you could lie to the world. Even the most ethical Muslim believes in Taria. Even the most honest Muslim who is filled with integrity, that you can eat in their home without fear and without worry, they believe in the concept of Taria. The concept being that when it comes to destroying the infidel and saving and defending the name of their great God, if it's all in that honor, we could lie, cheat, and steal. We could do whatever we want. And the Western world doesn't understand such a concept. They think the moment anyone from Iran comes forward to use the word peace, Americans get so excited. They want to throw a bar mitzvah anytime anybody from Iran says the word peace. But they don't understand what the Jewish culture had to face while they were there in Iran. Please, tell me. What? They call who?
The word
Tariyeh. Thank you. I'd like to carry on now a sidebar. This takes us over to Los Angeles. By the way, as has been going on to this entire history course, I want to get the history right. Because history, once you lock it in, you get the wrong history. So please, you're welcome to correct me. Middle, after, whatever it is. I'd rather get the right history than the wrong history. Before you know it, you have the wrong people in the wrong city at the wrong time, and then it's locked in forever. All right, now with recordings, it's for sure finished. Okay, let's take a sidebar story. Here we go. There's a little town. Many of the Jews lived in small towns. Besides just, we always hear of Tehran and all the Kohanim of Shiraz. But we don't understand that many Jews lived in small towns. Iran had its own Reseda as well, where some Jews lived as well. And one of those Resedas was Kashan. Kashan, the rabbi in Kashan was Harav Yedidya Shofet, was in Kashan. It's a dying community. And in January 1980, Rabbi Shofet moves to Tehran. His story is, I don't know why, please everyone should together speak to the family, I've mentioned it. Left earlier. When did he leave Kashan?
Early, late 1860s. No, he was there.
Somebody tell Rabbi David Shofet, somebody tell him.
No, he was
okay.
Chief rabbi for many years. I'm from Kashan, my parents.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Please talk to the Shofet family. His story needs to be written in English for everyone to see. You'll give me. Okay, I don't get the family politics. You tell me the right Shofet to talk. All right, no. The someone's got to write the story on Rabbi Shofet. His story is fabulous. I'll share with you some pieces. You tell me where I'm wrong, where we got it wrong. Oh, yes. The family gave me a copy of the picture. I have it in the pile. Now, he would go twice a year to the Shah. Twice a year. The Shah begged him not to leave. He begged the Shah, please don't leave us. Do not leave our community. He begged with tears. That last interaction where he begged with tears would be the last time that they would ever see each other face to face. Rav Yedidya Shofet, unfortunately, was forced, in a sense, to welcome the new Khomeini. And the questions of Mordechai and Ahasuerus, would they bow down? Would they say, Yechi Khomeini? Would they salute? Would they treat him? How would they treat him? The Khomeini understood the relationship and how adored the Shah was by, Khomeini knew how adored the Shah was by Rav Shofet. And that already meant that Rav Shofet knew he was on a list. He was on a very short list quickly. He was in too powerful a position to just say goodbye to Rabbi Shofet. But at the same time, Khomeini knew full well everyone's relationship with the Shah. Now, you have beyond that. Let's come to our Los Angeles story. Rabbi Shofet's son, Rabbi David Shofet, is getting smicha by someone you may have heard of by the name of Rav Avadia Yosef. He's learning in Bnei Brak, Rav Avadia Yosef, and he goes to sit with Rav Avadia Yosef, and he says to him, I am stuck between two worlds. I have a choice of going back to my mother country, where my people are struggling, life is not what it once was, or we have another option, and that is to follow the Jews, follow the Iranians who already have begun, the young community that already is more educated, knowledgeable, that already have begun to trickle in Los Angeles to meet the rest of their family members if they were there. Rav Avadia Yosef told Rabbi David Shofet, for you, follow your flock. I want you to follow your flock. He comes to Los Angeles and the first shul he encounters is a place called University Synagogue. Rabbi Shofet knows that that is not for him. That is not the shul for him. He needs to figure something out. This is where we come to the Beth Jacob part of the story. He has a meeting with Rabbi Maurice Lamb. He sits together with Rabbi Maurice Lamb of Beth Jacob, and he says, can we put together a Persian minyan over here in Beth Jacob? Rabbi Maurice Lamb speaks with the board, and the board approves the minyan in Bayer Hall. Approves the minyan in Bayer Hall. Now, to the best of my knowledge, this is the first convening of Iranians meeting for a minyan under the auspices of Orthodox authority. The first time Iranians here in Los Angeles meeting for a minyan under the context of Orthodoxy. Now this word Orthodoxy is a strange word to Iranians. It doesn't mean anything. There are no breakdowns of Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. This is a Western creation. This shtick of multiple denominations within Judaism, it got invented in the Western side of Europe. It was part of the Haskalah, the Enlightenment movement that was growing in the 1700s, further in the 1800s, that was ripping apart yeshivas. Right? The Reform and Conservative movement, Neo-Orthodoxy as well. You come to Los Angeles, and I've already discussed the breakdown of how Orthodoxy was a very small group in here in LA, suddenly building in the 50s and 60s, beginning to get traction because you finally have the one thing that's the glue, and that's the day schools. The yeshiva day schools are able to create the glue that's finally allowing the LA community to build. Suddenly the Iranians come and they don't know Orthodox, Conservative, Reform. They just see shuls. They see synagogues. Within 2 years of davening in Bayer Hall, it's packed. They decide to move up the block to Hillel. That fills up. Next, a theater on San Vicente. Next, Santa Monica and Franklin. The rabbi through this pivotal period is none other than the great Rabbi Yedidya Shofet. After that move, some of the young chevra of the shul band together, and raise money to be able to buy the Nessa Synagogue as we know it. Nessa Synagogue is a very interesting picture to look at to understand Iranian Orthodox Jewry here in Los Angeles. They're separate seating. And the mechitza is what you would call a very minimal mechitza. What's the history of the mechitza? Rabbi Shofet understood that as Iranians are coming to Los Angeles, they are finding comfort in the different synagogues that are here in Los Angeles. They are finding comfort in the synagogues here in Los Angeles. Let me give you a sidebar about religion and Iranians. For Eastern Jews, number one is emuna. Emuna is number one. For Ashkenazim, that's number three. For Eastern Jews, emuna is number one. Number two is Torah. The glory of seeing the Torah coming out of the ark is a cathartic experience which many westernized Jews will never be able to relate to, no matter how much they try. Number three is the practice. The melting pot of Los Angeles begins to change some of the identity. Many will go to Conservative and Reform shuls. Iranians are attracted to where it's famous, where the machers are, where some of the big and good-looking people are. Why? Why does it work like that? What of their culture draws them in that direction? So allow me to suggest the following theory. It's not proven, and I throw this out there, I know at the risk of getting pelted, but I'm going for it. The generation that first comes here is a generation that lives in the shadows of Queen Farah. Queen Farah is known for her regalness, her approach, her splendor, her larger-than-life existence. Everything is not just as it is, it's big, it's beautiful, it's celebrated. That was an attractive point for many Jews in Iran in the 1960s, in the 1970s. The notion of getting on a plane and flying to Paris and coming back with jewelry was a fascinating concept by someone who was a leader. You know, the equivalent here in America, you might say, is Jackie O. Jackie O. That notion, in a sense, may have carried over. That idea of not being afraid to live larger than life. Not being afraid that when you make a simcha, you make a simcha. You go all in. You go all out. I have no doubt that there are more sociological reasons behind that that go into it. But it's certainly an ingredient, an element that flavors the Jewish attraction to the conservative and reform synagogues as they come here, as they make their arrival here to LA. The American reaction to seeing these Iranians come in, I'll be honest, from the American side, they get nervous. Who are all these foreigners coming here? They're coming to take our kiddush away from us. That's the view, the racist view, looking at them, what are they doing in our buildings? What are they doing here? That line, that division between us and them. The Iranians went in with a smile on their face. You understand, culturally, when, these are stereotypes, by the way. I'm totally stereotyping. Culturally, when the French people become part of an Ashkenaz synagogue, they stay off to the side. They have a fear that they're not going to be accepted. They have a fear that, let me just avoid everybody at all costs. And until you bring them to the table, the French Jew will often stay to the side of the shul at Shalashuddis at their own table. The Iranian Jew came in with such excitement, with such vigor, they were not afraid to get involved right away. And they got involved at Sinai Temple. Initially, Western Jews looked and said, what is this? But look at the wall in Sinai Temple, and you'll notice there's a wall of the presidents. And you'll notice, they made it. They did it. Jews who were here no less than 5-6 years got themselves an education. They rebuilt their lives. They became doctors. They got on the board. They became machers. They became significant and chashuv people within their community. They had the grit. They had the chutzpah. They had the audacity. And they integrated themselves. And they put themselves front and centers. Front and center. There's another wave that keeps occurring. And by the way, I want you to know what leads another wave of Iranians coming to Los Angeles. A very interesting incident that most of you here may not know about. Two very important Jews, who shall remain nameless, go to meet with the Shin Bet. After meeting with the Shin Bet, they go ahead and they meet with the American Embassy in Tehran. They're sitting with the American Embassy, and they say to the American Embassy, we will talk about our community on condition you write nothing down. We're going to tell you our plans of getting out of here, of how we're going to leave, in what order, how we plan to dismantle the communities. The American Embassy agrees. We go into this meeting without pad, pen, paper, nothing. No recorders. Guess what? The diplomats who were sent to the American Embassy were no dummies. They remembered word for word every single conversation. And when the Iranian Jews left the meetings, the Americans wrote down everything. They documented every single thing. Why is that significant? Because when the embassy was sacked and dismantled, you know, the image of those papers being put together, you understand what some of those papers were when they were put together. They weren't just looking for the seven people that were being hidden and held at bay. They were looking at all the documents of what Americans wrote down about Persian Jewish life, Iranian Jewish life, and they found many of those documents. And that led to a quick and very dangerous overhaul of some Iranians over to America, to come here to America. This stuff could all be made into multiple, hope somebody goes for the screenplay rights tonight. Some of this stuff is unbelievable stuff. The story literally tells itself. We've only discussed one aspect of the Los Angeles Iranian community. We focused on Nessa's synagogue. And Nessa's a very unique place. They're discussing now the issue of mechitza is coming full force into the front. Do we need this mechitza anymore? Separation. The issues of microphone. We can't hear anymore in shul. The shul got so big and it's packed. Maybe we should bring in a microphone. Iranian Jews are facing modernity. They're facing these issues head on and grappling with them. But lest you think they're coming totally liberalized and modernized, I want you to understand another side of the story. The other side of the story is a struggle recently occurring at Sinai Temple. Rabbi Wolpe giving smicha, right? Rabbi Wolpe giving smicha to a gay rabbi. For Iranians within the Sinai Temple community, that's a red line. They're not used to such a concept culturally. They can adapt to the concept of possibly a microphone, possibly no mechitza, but that is a red line. And that's another interesting battleground that doesn't really happen in the Orthodox community, but it's interesting to note that it is going on. It was a huge struggle for Rabbi Wolpe at Sinai Temple, and one Iranian woman wrote in the Jewish Journal a whole article writing how she was embarrassed by her community after everything we went through in Iran, the persecution, to be against this. It's a tremendous struggle. It's a tremendous battle. And Nessa's synagogue is a battleground for so many hot-button issues that the Iranian community is now facing in religious Judaism. And it's fascinating from a historical perspective just to sit back and watch what is happening there. But I want to discuss a whole other side of the Iranian community here in Los Angeles. 5 to 10 years before the revolution begins, a Polish survivor establishes a set of yeshivas called Otzer HaTorah. Otzer HaTorah is a yeshiva that is designed to bring schools to the most far-flung reaches of the entire world. To find, you know, the children in any city that we could find. You can imagine sort of what Chabad does on a communal level. This was being done on a day school level. One of the emissaries who was sent to establish an Otzer HaTorah school was Rabbi Yitzchak Levi. Rabbi Yitzchak Levi helped establish schools in Tehran, in the smaller cities. He's going to help arrange funding for the teachers. And these schools are different. These schools have a very strong emphasis on Tanakh, on Mishnah, and these are going to be well-educated in the world of Torah. Many Iranians who are going to be well-educated are coming out of these schools. Those schools have a link in America because some of its graduates are going off to a school called Ner Yisrael in Baltimore. Ner Yisrael, one of the preeminent yeshivas in America. What's the relationship? One of these Otzer HaTorah school turned to Rabbi Sheftel Neuberger of Ner Yisrael. Sheftel Neuberger is sort of like a CEO figure of the Ner Yisrael yeshiva. They turned to him and they say, let our people get smicha in your yeshiva, they can come back and be educators in our communities. Some of the members of the Ner Yisrael community are upset about this. We're going to have an influx of people who are not from our world. This is a different hashkafa, a different worldview. Rabbi Neuberger said, this is not a suggestion. This is a must. This is about Jewish survival. That decision is a pivotal moment in the history of Orthodox Judaism for Iranians in Los Angeles. Because of those groups getting smicha, one of them is going to be Rav Zagari. Rav Zagari is going to start the Torat Chaim school here in Los Angeles. The Tashbar schools that open up, Tinoka Shel Beit Rabban, it stands for, the children of the houses of the rabbis. Those that study are going to get smicha, are going to be product of the Ner Yisrael. And that's why if you watch, and I'm talking as an outsider looking in, you are in the inside, will have a different perspective possibly, but I'm only sharing you my observations looking from the outside looking in. In front of my eyes, I see two Orthodox worlds opening up within the Iranian community. The Iranians that have modernized, that have become what we would call modern Orthodox Jews, that we've become integrated lawyers and professionals and doctors, and dress much like anybody else in a modern Orthodox day school. But then you're seeing something else develop. And that is what appears to us as the Haredi Iranian Orthodox Jew in Los Angeles. It's a community that is getting stronger and growing by the day. A community that has stronger and stronger leadership, that has many shuls that are representative of its hashkafa. and you're wondering where did this came from, because it's not a product of the host country. Neither is the, by the way, the modern Orthodoxy that's being adopted is neither a product of the host country, but it's being uniquely flavored. Understand something? A modern Orthodox Jew in California, he didn't look this way either. In Ashkenaz, modern Orthodox Jew looked different than Eastern Europe too. But what happens is, as you move to other countries, as you migrate, as the Jew wanders, he filters. He and she attempts to take in the best of what society has to offer, and you hope the education is strong enough to filter out those things that are not palatable with Judaism. That's the tension going on right now in this day in the Iranian community here in Los Angeles. What is the proper level of filter for our Orthodox community? Is the modern Orthodox model the one that works for us best? On one hand, it sort of resembles the life that the Shah designed for the Jews of Iran. But on the other hand, it has roles in Judaism that we never had. For example, the women's role in Judaism in Iran was far different than it is today. It's why you have something very unique. You can have an Iranian woman today who's far less observant of the details of halacha, but who goes to shul 1,000 times more than an Iranian in Tehran. It's a fascinating phenomenon. Because going to shul in Los Angeles is a major part of life, of being Jewish here. Coming to the synagogue, whether it's every Shabbat, whether it's once a month, whether it's for the high holidays, it's a major event. You could have families, women who remember in Tehran, kashrut was everything. Every detail of kashrut, how you cooked in your home, who ate at your home, who could not eat at your home. That was everything for you. Here, they may eat in a non-kosher restaurant, but they will know 10 times more Torah than a woman in Tehran may have known. Because that's the funny access that they have here in Los Angeles that's different than the access or the interest points or the markers of identification in Tehran and Shiraz and the other communities. And it's a fascinating shift. It's a fascinating shift. And the community is struggling with it. They're struggling. Where is our place? Where is our identity? Are we Haredi Iranian Jews? Are we modern Orthodox Iranian Jews? Are we conservative? Are we reform? Where do we stand? Where do we stand on the state of Israel? It's a very complex issue for Jews here in Los Angeles. Because our cousins who are left behind in Iran are not allowed to show support. And they've been indoctrinated in every school they send their kids to for the last 15 years. Zionists are evil. Israel is evil. And you cannot say that it doesn't have an impact after all those years. We all suffer the challenges of modernization. We all suffer from it. Some of us look to it and rise up to that challenge, and we end up much stronger than before. The stories yet to be told, the great stories of Rav Yedidya Shofet, as I began tonight, those stories are yet to be told for this community. I know the Ashkenaz community can only benefit from some of these amazing stories. A modern day Mordechai, a modern day Abarbanel, someone who had a relationship with the leadership, someone who saw the transitions of 3 different power bases to be here in Los Angeles. This was a gadol in our midst. This was a giant in our midst. And those of us who are not Iranian did not get to know that. We didn't get to appreciate it. We didn't get to see it. And what's going to impact further the future of Iranian children here in Los Angeles is if they have models of inspiration that they can look back to. They shouldn't just hear the gedolim stories of Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shach, as amazing, as great as they are. These children should be told in our Ashkenazi schools. They should be told the stories of Rav Yedidya Shofet. They should be told the story of the Jews who just, what was it, 12 years ago, 13 years ago, thrown into a prison, locked in there, in a modern era, being thrown into prison without a trial. Our children should be told that story. And that's going to be the future legacy of the Iranian community here in Los Angeles, the future responsibility. I want to close my discussion tonight with an amazing quote from Rav Yedidya Shofet. We must understand ourselves, know ourselves, what we are, who we are, and for what reason we came to this world. Those are prophetic words. Those are words of a rabbi who understood his community. He stayed the chief rabbi all those years because he knew how to adjust his message to the Jews in every generation. And he understood that the challenge of this generation for the Iranian community is going to be able to ask themselves, do we understand our mission? Do we know why we left? Were we just running away from something, or were we coming to something? That's the question they're going to ask. And the story of the Persian community here in Los Angeles, I'm telling you now, has yet to be told. And in 20 years from now, we'll continue this lecture. And we'll see in a very dynamic way that all of our schools and our shuls and our synagogues and our community will continue to be shaped by this confluence, by this integration between the Ashkenaz world, the westernized world, the modern world, and the religious world, which I'm going to get to in the next couple sessions of the history of Orthodox Judaism. I'm going to get to as I discuss the Lakewood Kollel arriving and the different Ashkenazi Haredi base that's grown and caused Torah to explode here. All these intersect with Iranians and Ashkenazim and Europeans and South American Jews all coming together here in Los Angeles in a very dynamic way. I thank you all for coming tonight.